Hello, and welcome to Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios. I'm here with my colleague Emily Peck of Axios.
Hi.
I'm here with Elizabeth Spires, who writes for the New York Times and is also a freelance writer for other places.
Hello.
We are going to talk about freelance writers, and specifically the ones who are members of the WGA union, who are on strike. What is going on with the writer's strike? Is it a good idea? What are the economics? We will unpack all of that. We will talk about monetary policy and the Fed and whether they're going to raise interest rates or not, what difference it would make. We are going to talk about China and whether the big CEOs of the world are going to be able to countervail against the G7 and all of the anti-China sentiment that is coming out of the US government and other governments. We have a Slate Plus segment on luxury amenities in movie theaters. It's all coming up on Slate Money. So all three of us here are writers, right? But none of us are on strike. Emily, you can't shake your head on a podcast. No one can see you when you do that.
They know I'm shaking my head, Felix. I'm a writer. I was, for a time, a member of the Writers Guild when I was at the Huffington Post, but now I am ununionized labor.
But even if you were a member of the Writers Guild at the Huffington Post, you still wouldn't be on strike.
No.
The writers' strike is an interesting strike because it's basically just self-employed writers who are going on strike.
Yeah.
And that's kind of amazing because it's one of the very few unions that I can think of where they actually have power and they're a strong union and they can go on strike effectively without actually having an employer to strike on. You know, it's just like they're their own employers. They're self-employed almost entirely. And they just say, you know what? We are collectively going to stop working for you. And that can be quite effective.
Yeah. I mean, they're self-employed, but they're 100% dependent on these big movie studios and now big streaming outfits such as Netflix.
Right. So that's the big thing. The main reason for the strike is that the old world of movie and TV writing had long-standing norms in terms of the number of writers per show and how much they would get paid and what kind of residuals they would get and all of this kind of thing. And the streaming services don't work in the same way. It's, you know, how would you calculate residuals, all of that kind of thing. And ultimately wind up paying less for writers than TV and movies. And the writers are seeing the writing on the wall and saying, we don't want to earn less, but obviously the world is moving to a world of streaming, so we're going to go on strike. Is that, Elizabeth, more or less the TLDR there?
Yeah, and there are a couple of other things happening there. One thing that happened with, you know, the increasing popularity of streaming is that the way that writers work on these shows changed a little bit. There's a good post online by George R. R. Martin, who wrote Game of Thrones, about how he got into TV writing, and he sort of describes it as an apprentice type job, you know, where you come in as a junior writer and you get exposed to all these aspects of production the more you rise through the ranks. And so he talks about having learned things like, you know, how the shows get budgeted, you know, how different aspects of production affect the way that you write the story and what you can write into a story. And what a lot of the streaming shows do now is they'll hire writers for a 6-week, what they call a mini room, where basically you have a showrunner and some senior level producers who are running, you know, the show, but they'll bring in the writers for 6 weeks to just scope out what's going to be in the episodes, you know, how the season's going to progress. And they get paid for those 6 weeks. And usually, you know, there was some consternation online about the fact that, you know, a typical payment might be $5,000 a week, which sounds like, you know, decent chunk of money, but it's not when you consider that that's before taxes, before you have to pay an agent and manager and lawyer and, you know, all this other stuff. But also, you only get paid part of it at the end of the writer's room, and then generally you get paid out several months later for the rest of it. So you might end up working for 6 weeks on something and it'll take you 6 months to fully get paid. And you're not paid to actually go off and write the episode that you're in charge of.
So who writes the episode?
The writer still has to write the episode, but they're not paid extra for that. You know, they're paid. So they're not paid for months at a time. And, you know, you could end up being in maybe too many rooms a year. And you just do the math there. It's just not sustainable for anybody. And it makes it impossible for junior writers to kind of come up through the system because they don't get that exposure to production anymore. So what the WGA wants to do is just completely abolish mini rooms.
And then and what instead?
And go back to a more traditional way of writing these shows, the kind that Martin describes where, you know, there's a bit of a ladder. You're paid for all the time you're spending on the show. You know, in a lot of cases, you would be working full time on a show for as long as it's in production. You know, the thing about the mini rooms is you're paid for part of the development and to deliver a script for usually an episode, but it's time delimited and it doesn't really take into account the work that you're putting into it after you're in the writer's room. So plus the usual, you know, disadvantages of being a freelancer. You know, you don't have benefits, you don't have protections in a lot of ways.
Wait, but that's not up for negotiation, right? I mean, they're still going to be freelancers either way.
Oh, sure. Yeah, but the mini rooms themselves and the structure are part of what's being negotiated.
But I guess the studios would argue that times are tight, that streaming doesn't make as much money as, you know, network and cable TV did for them. Their stocks are down, right? That's the argument they're making. Is there anything to that?
I mean, times are tight, right? And profits are down. And also the other thing which is very important to note is the amount of money in aggregate the writers are being paid is through the roof. The streaming boom has massively increased the number of writers who are members of the guild and who are writing for streaming and for, you know, TV and movies. So the total amount of money being paid by the industry for writers is up substantially, even as the median amount of money earned by writers is kind of stagnant to down a bit.
But, I mean, the streaming boom is over now. Like, they're starting to make less shows now, so that probably won't be true going forward, I would assume. It's already not quite as true as it was.
It's not over, actually. I mean, that's actually the weird thing. Netflix might be making slightly fewer shows in the United States, but there are still massively multiplying streaming services. If you look at something like Max, right, which has recently rebranded from HBO Max, and look at the sheer number of channels there are within Max, all of which have just insatiable demand for new content, there is a lot of new stuff appearing. It's not the stuff necessarily that is going to enter the popular consciousness and have Slate mini seasons devoted to it, but there's a lot of just sheer tonnage of material being produced in the way that is still as a level much, much higher than what we saw in the days of TV. It's maybe coming down a little bit from its peak, but it's still way above pre-streaming.
I think it's a lot harder to get stuff greenlit right now. I mean, part of what was happening during the boom was that shows were being commissioned and bought left and right, and then they would just never get made, or there would be a pilot, and then the series would be canceled. And now there's less of that. I think people are really making, you know, big bets on prestige shows that they think are really going to hit, and they're not paying for and then killing off things as much.
There's some other interesting stuff going on with this writer's strike. One thing I wanted to bring up is there's more solidarity now with writers, directors, and actors than there was. The last big strike was 2007 before streaming was a thing. That wasn't what the concerns were back then. And there was like tension between the directors and the writers. And now there's like a lot of solidarity. And I was talking to Axios's Tim Basinger. He covers this pretty closely. And he was just saying that everyone in the industry sees streaming as kind of like an existential threat, basically, that the current state of the content biz. Yeah, there's the very, the career paths of these people feels at stake. Like you can, and I think that's interesting because it kind of is like the last holdout when it comes to content makers. Like this is, like journalism has already, and writers, nonfiction writers, book writers, like we've all been decimated by digital already, right? Like you can't have most people can't have like a middle class career path in journalism. The music industry has been kind of rocked, I think, and decimated also by digital. But like content, TV, it's taken a way longer time. And I think in part because, or maybe mostly because it is unionized and they can actually fight back and fight for better pay. Whereas the other industries I mentioned, there's no union fighting for people.
Music is interesting because, again, what you see in the music industry, if you look at the total amount of money being funneled to songwriters and performers, it's up substantially. Like the streaming boom is huge. If I'm paying, you know, $10 a month for Spotify, $120 a year, that's probably more. I mean, that is more than I ever typically used to spend on, you know, CDs or LPs or whatever.
No way.
Yeah, I never used to buy so many of those. Like, it's now just like a... And plus, of course, all of the ad-supported stuff, every time I listen to something on YouTube or anything like that, if you look at the total amount of money going to songwriters and performers, it is up substantially. But also, the number of songwriters and performers is up. And again, you have the same phenomenon where the average and the median are going down, even as the aggregate are going up.
That makes sense. And you could see the same in like in journalism. There's more people doing it.
Oh, absolutely.
Less, but yeah. Making way less money, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, I live in a part of Brooklyn that I think of as dad band land because every third person is in an actual commercial touring band. And I just anecdotally, I hear the musicians talk about this stuff. And the extent to which, you know, they don't make money directly off the music anymore as much. You know, it's you have to tour more, you have to come up with, you know, inventive merch lines, things like that, because the music itself isn't paying as well.
Right. But the point is that there are more, you know, dads in bands in Brooklyn than there ever were. It wasn't like there was some halcyon era where like half of Brooklyn was making lots of money from being in dad bands.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like
now we're in
comfort.
Now
to
we're
the
in a world
though.
Where
that's not
but that's exactly right. Like, you know, and we're seeing the same thing with the writer's strike, which is it's cold comfort to any individual writer to be told that, you know, the aggregates are up because all they care about is what they're making individually. And conversely, from the point of view of the industry, they're saying like there is this insane digital content more and we can never feed it enough stuff. Yeah. Like Emily and I both made the transition from print journalism to digital journalism, and the just the order of magnitude increase in the amount of content that needed to be created in order to be a player, you know, in this industry. The sheer amount of stuff you need to produce in digital is so much higher than it ever was, you know, in the olden days. And films and TV are still a kind of like artisanal industry. You know, Hollywood moves very slowly and they still have writers' rooms and producers and all of these like old-fashioned structures that are slowly being dismantled by the digital industry because they just need to be able to produce more content more quickly. Obviously, the writers don't love that. But as a Brit, you know, I listen to all of these stories of writers' rooms and unionized contracts and residuals and, you know, just look at the sheer number of writers who work on any given show. And I'm like, that's insane. You know, like in the UK, if you look at like a UK TV show, it's like two people sitting in a room and just writing the script. And that just doesn't happen. That's not allowed to happen in the UK. I mean, in the US.
Well, that's happening though because of things like mini rooms. So you get a credit on the show, but you're not there during production. Like that's, I think part of the reason why the strike has been effective speaks to what Emily was just saying, which is that there's a lot more solidarity. But some of the solidarity is very self-interested. If you look at these prestige TV shows and movies that people want to be a part of, they're very heavily writer-driven. I mean, Succession is a prime example of that. And in the case of Succession, you know, the writers were involved in, you know, every step of everything, you know, from, you know, evaluating the music and the costuming, and they were on set and they were interacting with the actors. And that's not always the case anymore. And so I think there is a bigger incentive for people all the way down the production chain to be in solidarity with the writers on this one, because you just end up with better quality shows and movies and better parts for the actors.
And quality is really important in TV and movie writing. Like, yes, there are good TV shows and bad TV shows, good movies and bad movies, but they're all kind of good in that they all work. Like, in order for a movie to get made and shown in a theater, it has to, you know, be coherent, have a story, like, make sense, have continuity. Like, these are hard things to do and pull off, and, like, you need quality people to work on them, from the writing to the production. It just seems like it would be a shame to for these writers not to get their demands met. Don't you think?
No more.
Okay, like, I am shocked that Emily Peck has come out in favor of the unions who are on strike. I mean, you could knock me over with a feather.
I mean, at first I was kind of like, wait, so they're working in these mini rooms on shows that, you know, it's no longer a 22 episode show. It's like an 8 or 10 episode show. And so they're making less money. Like, doesn't that just make sense? That actually is a question, actually. I'll just put it to Elizabeth. So they're working on fewer episodes and making less money. And they're like, we should make more money. I don't quite get that part.
Well, it's not just the fewer episodes. It's the entire structure of mini rooms being normalized within the industry, where you're just getting lower pay for more work categorically, and you get it and takes so long to get paid. You know, it makes it creates a lot of uncertainty if you're a freelancer, where you might work on 2 mini rooms a year, and so people are having to take, you know, other jobs that are not writing jobs just to make ends meet in a lot of cases. And we always hear about the outlier situations where people make a ton of money doing TV writing, but the average writer doesn't. You know, it's much more akin to...
The average writer makes a ton of money. The average writer, the average union member makes $250,000 a year. Like, now, there is a lot of variation in there, but the mean is really high. The median is
low. Well, the median is more what I'm talking about, because all it takes is, you know, a bunch of well-paid people at the high end that are very small percentage to pull the average up. But if you look at the credits in any TV show you look at and you see 20 writers in the credits, most of those people are not getting paid $200,000.
On the other hand, if you look at the credits for a TV show and you see 20 people, 20 writers, you're like, why the hell are there 20 writers? Like, this is me. This is the Brit in me going, like, there is a long tradition of amazingly high quality British television. And I don't think there has ever been a show in British history which has had 20 writers. It's just like, I don't necessarily think that more writers equals better writing. And we do seem to have wound up in the stage of negotiations where one of the demands is, like, we've got to keep these minimum size of the writers' rooms. And so long as the writers' rooms have a minimum size in terms of the number of writers, like, that reduces the amount of money there is per writer, right?
Yeah, that's not how it works, though. It's more akin to a newsroom deciding that they're going to eliminate all of their staff writers and keep one editor and just use freelancers for everything else.
So there's a lot of freelancers, but not necessarily.
Yeah, a lot more bylines, but you're not necessarily spending more money or expanding your staff.
Well, no one's on staff. Everyone's freelance. We understand that. I'm just saying that the union does have pretty strict minimums for the number of writers per show.
I also, there's a very big difference between being staffed on a show where you are considered staff. Like, yeah, you're probably technically still an independent contractor, but you're being paid for everything that you're doing on the show. So you go to a production meeting, you're getting paid for that. If you're consulting on something, you're getting paid for that. If you're interacting with the crew, that's, you know, with the mini rooms, you're just getting paid for that 6 weeks of development and then the final deliverable.
Oh, so it's like, I get that. So it's like going from, like, you are really an integral part of the show as a writer to, we just bring you in when we need you, like a plumber.
Yeah, not even that. You know, it's more like you deliver your version of the script, and you may not even be involved in how it gets revised or anything like that.
So we're in, it's the about a month of the strike going on, and I don't even think the parties are at the bargaining table, so this could go on a while.
Yeah, I think the streamers in particular have enough content in their hoppers to be able to just keep on streaming what they've got. One of the interesting differences between linear TV and streamers is that on linear TV, you really do need to produce new stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't have a self-respecting TV channel that is just showing only reruns. Whereas with streamers, like, you know, it's fine. Netflix has a million shows it can newly resurface to the top of the homepage and will be unfamiliar to almost all of its viewers. And it doesn't need new content in the same way.
Yeah.
I think they do, though. I mean, that's part of what made Netflix successful when streaming started, was that they started producing original content that really works for them. And also, you know, the strikes are shutting down production on some of these things. You know, they're losing $200K to $300K a day for that, and it's not insured either. That's just money out the door.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a new tactic you're talking about, Elizabeth, where people go to live productions and pick it in front of there to try and shut them down. So that's a little different, right? Because that's not writers being on strike. It's writers disrupting productions of things that were already written. Yeah.
And it also, to Elizabeth's point, you know, there is still a large number of shows, including shows like Succession, where having writers on set is part of how they produce the show. So mm-hmm. if the writers are on strike, then they can't produce the show because those writers are necessary for the production of the show. You know, I saw that the second season of Severance has like paused production because that's one of those shows.
Oh, I like Severance. That's sad. Sad for me.
Oh my God, Emily, you should come out against the strikers because you're not going to get Severance season two as quickly as we thought.
No, I think the
pay the Severance writers. Then it's.
We should move on. Let's talk about Fed policy.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Okay, so we had another monster huge jobs report this week. 339,000 new jobs created, something like that. Came in the wake of pretty hot inflation numbers. And yet the Fed looks like it's not going to raise rates in a couple of weeks. And the current conversation is an interesting one. It seems to be around this question of skip or pause. Emily, how do you characterize the difference between a skip and a pause?
It's the same thing. So basically a skip means that at the next meeting, the Fed is not going to raise rates. It's going to pause. It's not going to raise rates, but it might raise them the next time after that. Thus a skip, because it's raise, stop raising, raise again. So that's a skip. Whereas a pause would be a more definitive stop. Do I have that?
Yeah, pause. I guess it's about expectations. If you think that everything's going to adapt to the current interest rate hikes, you argue for pause and assume that inflation will come down naturally. And then if you're arguing for skip, it's that you expect it not to do that, and you're going to have to raise rates in July.
But the Fed has been saying all along, like, we're going to be watching to see what financial conditions are doing and make decisions based on that, which to me is like, we could skip, we could pause, we'll see how it goes kind of a thing. So skip pause seems like a weird fake thing to talk about because people don't know how to deal with the uncertainty of what the Fed has been saying.
So one way to think about it is just the size of the rate hike or the size of the average rate hike. At the beginning of the tightening cycle, the rate hikes came every meeting at 50 basis points apiece. Then, you know, as we got into the tightening cycle, those 50 basis point hikes were reduced to 25 basis point hikes, but still a 25 basis point hike every meeting. So if you want to reduce it by half again, so it's like 12 and a half instead of 25, then what you do is you do a 25 basis point hike every other meeting, you know, and you're still kind of raising rates, but you're just doing it more slowly. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so that's the skip, right? The market was pricing in like basically one hike between June and July for a while. And then as the Fed officials have been coming out and saying they are thinking about doing a skip, basically what the market did was just decide that one hike was going to happen in July rather than in June, which is not a big deal. But what it does is it preserves optionality, right? It gives them an extra month to just see how the economy is doing. And because the one thing they don't want to do is go too far and then be forced to pull back, right? They have the luxury of time now. It's not urgent that they hike rates. And so they can hike rates a little bit, pause a little bit, do a little bit more, pause a little bit until they're sure they're in the right place without having to just like go storming ahead and then go, oh shit, we went too far and now we need to cut.
Yeah, it's like you're filling up a bucket or something. And at first it's really easy to fill the bucket because it's empty and you can just shoosh the water in. But then as you get closer to the top, you have to be a little careful not to spill
exactly.
over.
Exactly. And when rates were at zero, it was very clear that they were too low. You know, when inflation came up, they were like, oh shit, we need to raise rates. We don't know how high we need to raise them to, but we know we need to raise them to a level that's significantly higher than they are right now. Now, with rates at 5%, it is not clear that rates are too low. You know, 5% counts as tight monetary policy, and there's argument about how tight it is, but it's definitely tight enough to be slowing down the economy already. So we don't know how much effect that's having. And so does it need to be higher than 5%? Does it need to be much higher than 5%? These are very subtle decisions that the Fed needs to make. And so I think it's just going to take its time with them.
But inflation is still high. You know, the Fed was supposed to hike rates so that inflation will come down. It has come down, but it's still not at the 2% target. It's like correct. A little under 5%.
So the question is, do you keep on hiking rates until inflation is at 2%? Or do you keep rates high until inflation is at 2%? Because rates are now high and quite plausibly, given that inflation is coming down quite dramatically, just keeping rates high could be enough to bring inflation down.
Well, there were a couple of Fed governors who expressed concern about uncertainty around how credit conditions are evolving, because there are, you know, non-monetary factors that could contribute to inflation going down. And we still don't really understand the full ramifications of the spring's bank failures and how it's going to affect lending.
Well, wait, when you say non-monetary factors, what you mean the credit conditions of the monetary factors or the non-monetary factors?
Non-monetary factors.
Non-Fed factors.
So what are the monetary factors?
If credit tightens and it becomes harder to obtain a loan because banks are more cautious in the wake of the bank failures, then that could pull inflation down.
Yeah, but isn't that the main mechanism of what Fed hikes do? Like if interest rates rise and that causes credit to tighten?
Yeah, interest rates are only one factor, though, in credit tightening. So there's also the number of loans that are approved, the size of the loans.
I feel like it's all the same thing. Like ultimately, like, you know, when the Fed raises rates, the aim is for banks to lend less and for borrowers to demand fewer loans. And, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other. Like, partly borrowers will demand fewer loans because the rates are higher. Partly the banks will lend less because, you know, they have less appetite to lend to borrowers who they're now worried might not be able to repay loans at those kind of interest rates. But I feel like that mechanism of credit tightening is exactly the main mechanism that the Fed uses to try to bring down inflation. It's not some kind of unanticipated other thing.
Yeah, well, I agree that rates are the main factor, but there are non-rate conditions, especially in response to things like bank failures, that are not just interest rate driven. They're about, you know, banks being more conservative.
No, but the bank failures were entirely interest rate driven. They were 100% a function of interest rates. But yeah, I mean, I think like we're not really disagreeing here. I think we agree that the rise in interest rates has caused tighter financial conditions by design, and you know, maybe they didn't want the bank failures to happen, but I don't think they were super upset that the bank failures happened because they were part of like trying to bring down the risk appetite in the economy. That's the whole purpose here.
I mean, the point is that the Fed hiked rates a lot, and it takes a while for those rate hikes to kind of play out in the economy. And now we're at a point where they can kind of wait and see what happens, like credit, how tight is credit going to get and how much will that affect inflation? We might want to wait and see a little more. We might want to wait and see if, you know, wages stop rising so quickly or if the job market weakens a little bit more. Like, let's just like chill for a second.
Exactly. And that was a little piece of good news in the jobs report this week, as far as the Fed was concerned, is that wage inflation is still coming down. It's lower than it has been basically since the pandemic. So the Fed likes to see that. The big question, which I can't answer at all and is very unclear, I think, even to the Fed, is, you know, to what degree does tightening credit actually slow the economy? To what degree does economic growth rely on borrowing? And I think there's a lot of interesting economic growth out there in the economy right now that is really consumer driven and doesn't require businesses borrowing lots of money. And if they don't need to borrow money to grow, then making it more expensive to borrow money or more difficult to borrow money isn't going to slow down the economy very much.
That's an interesting point. It makes me think about the housing market, because the Fed raising rates absolutely crushed the housing market. Like there's hardly any home sales going on right now. And most people are just like happily living in their houses with their low mortgage rates that they got before the rate hiking started. And I guess before that all that happened, I had this, you know, very like financial crisis perspective of the housing market. Like if the housing market craters, like everyone will die. Like we saw what happened last time. But that's not at all what happened. It just like no one's taking out mortgages really or doing refinancing, and it's hurt the mortgage industry, but it hasn't really like cratered the economy in any kind of real way.
Well, the big difference between now and 2007 is that house prices have not cratered. Like the number of
sales, because no one's selling their house, so we don't know what prices are.
Well, no one's selling their house. So what you, in terms of the supply and demand dynamics, like there's always people who need to buy a house for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And those people who need to buy a house are faced with much lower inventory than they normally would see. And so they are still being forced to pay high prices for a house just because no one wants to sell.
Yeah.
And it does feel a little bit unsustainable. And there is a weird feeling there that like maybe the next shoe is going to drop and prices are going to have to come down because affordability is off, you know, is crazy right now given the price of mortgages. But the one thing I've learned over and over again is that whenever someone predicts that, you know, such and such a financial effect is going to cause house prices to go down, whether it's, you know, the end of mortgage interest deductibility in the UK or whether it's higher mortgage rates or whatever, like it almost never does. Houses have this incredible ability to not go down in value, which is one of the reasons why the 2007 fall in house prices was such a shock. Like no one thought that houses could fall that much. And it turns out that like that was really exceptional and was really a function of a whole bunch of people having bought houses that they literally couldn't afford.
They had to lose their homes.
But the point was they couldn't pay their mortgages.
Right.
Right now, everyone can pay their mortgage.
Right.
Like, mortgage credit quality is off the charts. So long as people are paying their mortgages, I don't know if we're going to see the house, you know, significant house price declines.
Right. So that's where like the credit tightening doesn't really matter that much, you know?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
We're also not seeing rents come down. And that's an important part of the housing services category, which is another thing that people are looking at. So,
in fact, if you look at inflation, rents are 100% of the housing component of inflation. It's a weird quirk of the way that inflation is measured that what the statisticians do is if you're paying rent, they look at how much rent you're paying. And if you own your home, they work out what they call imputed rent, which is basically how much rent you're paying to yourself, you know, for the value of your home. And they impute that rent from actual rents that people pay. What house prices, whether they're going up or down, have very little effect on inflation, whereas rents have a huge effect, not just on renters, but even on homeowners in terms of the way that CPI is calculated.
One thing that might be interesting to watch now in terms of inflation and cooling economy vibes is the student loan pause is finally unpausing. Speaking of pause and skip, we are unpausing and not skipping. And because part of the debt ceiling deal that just passed was that they couldn't pause anymore. So a lot of people are going to have to start making student loan payments that haven't had to do that in like 3 years. And that might actually slow things down a bit because I would think that most people stopped sort of budgeting for that money. So they're going to have to find it in other ways and places that could theoretically slow down a little bit of discretionary spending. Maybe that is something the Fed is also watching. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a bummer.
Could do the Fed's job for it.
Yeah. There you go.
Thank you, Joe Biden, for helping with fiscal policy.
What a bummer though, if you haven't paid that bill in 3 years and now you gotta pay it again. I don't know. This feels like
Emily's like, I don't know, I don't have any student loans, I'm too old for that shit.
I paid my student loan off, and then the following year I got a mortgage. So it was just like, what are you going to do? America.
Let's move on and talk about China.
Hello, I'm Imi Harper. On the Slow Newscast from Tortoise, I tell the story of how a Hong Kong billionaire was silenced.
I got bombs thrown into my house. I got people came here, ransacked my computer. And I got people fractured me. I got this and that, but I'm safe.
And what it reveals about the freedoms Hong Kong no longer enjoys. Listen to Hong Kong's Rebel Billionaire on the Slow Newscast, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, Elon Musk was in China this week. He was quoted as saying that the US and China are like conjoined twins. They're so close and that relationship is so important. Whether he actually said that is a little bit unclear because he was only quoted in like an official Chinese press release. Jamie Dimon was also in China. He gave a speech talking about how much he loves China and how much he wants JP Morgan to help Chinese people. JP Morgan is expanding very quickly in China. It's doubled its headcount there in the past few years. Tim Cook was just in China giving a speech there and was warmly welcomed. The big luxury goods magnates on their way to China and trying to shake hands with all the right ministers. Business in general is really trying very hard to be as friendly as possible to China and grow as fast as it can in China and make as much money as it can from China. And Emily, you are convinced that all of this is doomed because geopolitics.
Yeah, so even as all these CEOs heart China, the U.S. government doesn't heart China anymore, or at least the official rhetoric of the U.S. government is very anti-China right now.
Correct.
And we just had a G7 meeting in Japan where people were also not loving on China. And I just think if push comes to shove, the CEOs aren't going to win this one. But now that I'm talking about it, you know, maybe they will. We really still need China for the economy and the U.S. to function. Everyone loves their cheap stuff. I don't know. People want inflation to come down. And if you cut out China, that's going to be a problem. But I still think at the end of the day, like if the U.S. government is making enemies with China, then the CEOs ultimately have to fall in line.
Yeah. If the U.S. government tells NVIDIA that it's not allowed to sell its latest generation AI chips to China, then it's not allowed to sell its latest generation AI chips to China. And that is a huge potential market for those chips. Now, I don't think that applies to Starbucks and Nike. You know, I don't think the U.S. government sees a major national security threat in Chinese people drinking Starbucks. So maybe it depends what industry you're in.
Yeah, for tech CEOs, I think, to use internet parlance, they need to be frenemies with China. So they want some regulation, but they're still very dependent on China for manufacturing and materials and distribution.
Oh, I mean, if you're Tesla, you are completely reliant on China because you're basically a batteries company and all of the batteries are made in China.
Right. And Apple, too. I think they've tried to move some of their manufacturing out of China, but they still have a big chunk there. Right.
And like 40, you know, it's by far their second largest market, consumer market. You know, China is a huge source of demand for both Apple and Tesla, but also for like GM. GM sells more cars in China than it does in the US.
Right. I guess, I mean, like what we saw in Russia, like we were okay with companies being in Russia up until they invaded Ukraine. Like something really shocking would have to happen to really disrupt the corporate alliance with China.
And when you say something really shocking, you mean they would have to invade Taiwan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like at that point, I think I agree. All bets are off. We just have no idea what the response would be among in public opinion, among governments, and what kind of pressure would there be on companies to like leave China.
Yeah.
It's a huge unknown. I genuinely have no idea. On some level, it was relatively painless for companies to leave Russia. No companies were that embedded in Russia.
China would
be much more painful, and I think people would be much more reluctant to do that.
Yeah.
Even in the event of an unprovoked invasion of Taiwan, which is definitely something that the G7 was worried about. You know, there's a lot of talk in the G7 communique about, like, come on, people, can you stop building islands in the South China Sea and stop your territorial maximalism?
China basically took over Hong Kong and there was no invasion or anything. Can't China do like a soft takeover of Taiwan and then no one has to rush to its aid?
So the big difference like, no, is that, like, no, I mean, this is, no, it's a really good question, right? What China did in Hong Kong over the, you know, at the height of the pandemic was really shocking. Mm-hmm. And I think was, no one really expected it to be that aggressive. And Hong Kong, which was this bastion of freedom, lost all of its freedoms more or less overnight. And the response of the world to that was a lot of tutting and, you know, pro forma condemnations, but nothing real. And Hong Kong remains a major economic center and no one's boycotting Hong Kong. And life goes on, and I fear that China's going to learn exactly the wrong lesson from that. Now, yeah, the reason was that no one disputed that Hong Kong was part of China. And yes, China did have a treaty obligation to not do what it did, and it totally violated the 1997 treaty with Britain, the one country, two systems thing. But Hong Kong was clearly and unambiguously part of China in the way that Taiwan is not. Like, China will say that Taiwan is part of China. And, you know, the world's governments don't generally recognize Taiwan to be an independent country, but they definitely have made it clear that they're willing to defend its status with guns.
Don't you think that if China was willing to take that kind of risk, they would have aligned more heavily or just aligned generally with Russia and the Ukrainian?
I think they did.
Or the war in the Ukraine?
I mean, I think that's exactly what they did.
Not the way people were anticipating. I mean, not the way they have historically. There was a hesitancy to give them arms. They're not funding Russia the way Ukraine is being funded.
Right. China's not, like, literally giving Russia money, but the trade between Russia and China. China's buying a huge amount of Russian oil. You know, that trade is still going strong. China has not condemned the invasion. And, you know, there's a very interesting dance going on right now between China, Russia, and India. Like, Chinese-Indian relations are particularly bad right now, which is interesting. India has a relatively, you know, opportunistic, I would say, relationship with Russia. They're happy trading with Russia as well. They haven't condemned the invasion. And none of them really like each other, but they're all of them at the same time understand that they would like there to be some alternative to US hegemony. None of them particularly want to live in a unipolar world where the only country that matters is the United States. Meanwhile, the United States really wants to maintain its unipolar hegemonic domination. And so it's an interesting sort of dance that, like, you know, India, Russia, and China aren't completely cooperating, but they're not cooperating in terms of trying to create some kind of, but, you know, alternative pole to America.
They're like frenemies, to use Elizabeth's word.
the enemy of my enemy is mm-hmm. my friend.
Everyone has so many enemies these days. It's important. It's impossible to keep up.
Keep your friends close. Keep your frenemies closer.
Exactly. I like that. numbers round. Elizabeth, do you have a number?
Yeah, my number is 5 million, and that's dollars, and that's the prize pool for Major League Pickleball, which
wow.
I just learned
how many
today
dollars?
Is a thing that
wow.
exists. $5 million.
$5 million
and
for pickleball.
There is now a Major League Pickleball.
How many different people are going to share this $5 million of pickleball?
No idea. This is the Major League Pickleball League is run by Brian Levine, who's a former Goldman Sachs partner, and this is fairly new, so unclear how big the pickleball market is.
Where's the championship being held?
I want to know, like, if I'm a pickleball player, how much money can I make playing pickleball? Are there massive sponsorship deals as well? Is Nike going to have, like, Nike pickleball?
You play pickleball, right, Felix?
I tried to play it once, but I was It turns out I was on the wrong kind of tennis court. It was like a clay court and the ball didn't bounce the right way. But I have aspirations to pickleballing.
I would like to play.
Central Park is going to add 14 pickleball courts this year, I think.
Oh, you're never going to be able to book one of those.
Yeah, there's no way I'm going to be. Yeah, that's going to be a whole thing. My number is 8.73 million, which is the number of self-employed workers in America, according to the latest household survey. This is people who just work for themselves but haven't set up a business. And that number is the lowest it's been since the pandemic. In fact, it's lower than it was pre-pandemic. Obviously, it fell down enormously during that brief recession of April 2020. But there was a big boom in self-employment in 2021. Everyone was YOLOing it and going, I'm going to work for myself and do my own thing. And some of those decisions worked out, and a lot of those people then incorporated and became actual companies. And others of those decisions didn't work out, and they just decided to stop being self-employed and get a job because there's lots of jobs out there. And now people aren't quitting their jobs and going self-employed so much. Also, the writer's strike is playing into this. Like, a lot of writers are self-employed, but also unemployed. So we have a particularly low number of self-employed people in America right now. It's down 369,000 in 1 month, which is even bigger than the rise in payrolls.
It's like a good news, bad news kind of number.
Yeah.
Because some people probably are better off with jobs than, like, selling candles or something.
Exactly. You know, trying to make their way as an Instagram influencer.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a rough life. And there's no union.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine the influencers union?
I would love to see it.
Emily, what's your number?
I have two, like, joke numbers I'm deciding between. I'm going to go with $45,000.
Oh, okay.
That's the average price of a cold plunge pool sold by Diamond Spas and Pools in Frederick, Colorado. There's a big story in the Wall Street Journal this week about the hottest new home amenity, the cold plunge pool. People who have $1 million and plus homes and whatnot are building these in their, like, spa rooms, you know. They have saunas, they may have regular pools. Now they have cold plunge pools. And these are pools of cold water that people plunge into. Yeah, exactly.
For wealthy
for like a minute, for 45 seconds to a minute, because it's supposed to be, like, good for you, I guess.
Isn't there some, like, Dutch guy called Wim or something who's really into, like, cold swimming and cold water? Isn't that also always how saunas are supposed to work? You go in the sauna and then you jump into a piece of cold water. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it is. There's always been a cold plunge, but now there are more cold plunges in people's homes. And, you know, people are saying things like, you're activating your body system by plunging in the cold and it's good for your this or that and it speeds your recovery time and athletes like it. And it's just the latest thing. And I just want to say I don't like it.
A cold bath is not a good substitute.
You can do a cold plunge in a bathtub, but it's not. Then you haven't spent the $45,000. So, like, what are you even doing, Elizabeth?
Emily, do you think $45,000 is a lot for a cold plunge pool?
I do. Because you only spend, like, 45 seconds in the thing every day. Like, you know, get a regular pool. I'm a big hot tub kind of. I like a hot plunge. You know what I mean? Cold is, I'm just not. It's not for me.
Would you like a hot plunge pool?
Yeah, isn't that like what a hot tub is, Felix?
That's a hot tub.
Yeah, I would like a hot plunge pool.
I feel like a hot tub is more, your typical hot plunge pool is more expensive than $45,000. I might be wrong about that.
Oh, I don't know. I could Google it now, but I'm not going to because it's the end of the show. And people can do that themselves.
It's not the end of the show. We have a Slate Plus segment coming up on what cinemas are doing to try and get people back into cinemas. But for those of you out there, we love you too, who don't listen to Slate Plus, who aren't subscribed to Slate Plus, that is actually the end of the show. Thank you to Patrick Fort for producing. We are not back on Monday with another Succession podcast because Succession is over. It is very sad. But at some point we will come back with movies or villains or something like that. But yeah, for the time being, you're going to have to wait another week before the very next Slate Money.